Back in 2002, Rafe Sagarin was working as a science advisor to Congresswoman Hilda Solis. She's now the Secretary of Labor. It wasn't long after 9/11, and Sagarin started noticing how some of his colleagues were dealing with the heightened security measures on Capitol Hill.
I'd watch these other Capitol Hill staffers, and I noticed that they just put their hand over their keys in their pockets so they didn't have to waste 30 seconds putting it on the conveyor belt, and that didn't set off the alarm when they did that. And it just made me think, adaptable organisms, if you're talking about an adaptable terrorist, is going to figure out a way to get around this. And I started to think about organisms in nature, which are constantly adapting, and started to think, well, what could we learn from all that adaptation in nature about how to make better security systems?
The animal he turned to? The octopus. Rafe Sagarin's new book is called Learning from the Octopus, and it describes how secrets from nature can help us avoid disasters. And when we spoke, I asked him, why the octopus?
Most adaptable systems, and the octopus is a great example, have a decentralized organization where a lot of almost independent parts are allowed to sense and respond to the environment. So the octopus doesn't use that great brain to tell arm one to turn purple and arm two to turn blue as it swims over a coral reef, but rather millions of cells spread across its body are each individually responding to that change in their environment and then giving camouflage to the octopus as a whole. That combination gives you a lot of what you need to be an adaptable organism.
These things are intuitive. This is that amazing video that came out a year or so ago of an octopus using coconut shells to protect it as sort of this armor. The octopus just does those things, but you're suggesting that we focus our thought process on a range of possible options and reactions?
It's not completely intuitive. It does have a cognitive mind that thinks about these things. The coconut shells is a good example where it had to piece that together, but it also has these more automatic things. And we as humans have that as well, but we're sort of too clever by half by trying to plan and predict and make perfect solutions to our security problems, when in fact all of nature, including the octopus, don't spend a lot of time planning. They just try to solve problems in the environment as they arise.
There's an example you talk about with the U.S. military, the issue of IEDs, improvised explosive devices, which, as you point out, they're still among the biggest killers of our troops in Afghanistan and a scourge for many years in Iraq. What's your argument for why the military has not adapted to that threat?
Yeah, well, there you see two sides of adaptability. You had the Department of Defense, which planned for and predicted a certain kind of war, which turned out to be not the war at all that they were fighting. And it was all those soldiers on the ground who are acting as these semi-independent sensors, just like the skin cells on the octopus, who almost immediately recognized that the IED threat was the big problem. It took the Department of Defense with a centralized top-down control system 3 years to bring out up-armored vehicles into Iraq. Those soldiers on the ground had to adapt in the meantime. And one of the things that they did is develop symbiotic partnerships, even with people that were previously shooting at them. And it was through those partnerships that they started to get the intel about the IEDs and who were the bomb makers and that sort of thing. And you see a big drop in IED deaths before these up-armored vehicles came into Iraq.
We often hear, and it seems pretty self-evident, that humans are actually very adaptable, that it might take us some time, but we do eventually figure it out. And I'm wondering, what example can we sort of take from the natural world and then apply to our experience and say, we're just not doing that?
Well, it's really about this decentralized organization. That starts it all, and there's a very simple thing we can do in wherever we work that can shift us into this mode of having more sense of how the world is changing and having more ability to respond to it. And that is shifting from a mode of giving orders to issuing challenges, which is when we say, here's a problem we're all facing. Who among you can solve this problem best? And every time we've seen a challenge-based attempt at problem solving, you get many more potential responses and potential solutions. You get them much quicker and much, much more cheaply than the model where a small group of experts decides or a single contractor is decided to develop something.
That's Rafe Sagarin. He's a marine ecologist and author of the new book, Learning from the Octopus, from KUAZ in Tucson, Arizona. Rafe, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.
In Peter Carey's new novel, the hero and heroine are separated by 150 years. Henry and Catherine never meet, but they are brought together by an object, a piece of technology. It's an enormous 19th century mechanical duck, an automaton. As the two narratives unfold, the duck becomes a swan, and many of its inner workings are revealed. This is not true for the difficult, mysterious characters who populate the book. Author Peter Carey has won the Man Booker Prize twice. His new book is called The Chemistry of Tears, and he joins us from our bureau in New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So there are some complex themes in this book, a lot of things left unsaid, but one of the themes, I believe, that you're exploring here is the kind of human relationship with technology, somehow providing structure to these characters. Is that fair?
Well, I began thinking about how all of that wonderful, bright invention of the 19th century and the Industrial Revolution and before that demonstrates human beings as playful and inventive and capable of amazing things, and how all of that has really led us to the present plight we face on the planet, where we appear to be poisoning ourselves. So that's a relationship between humans and technology, in which the humans are at once the pure inventors and pure souls, and also the victims of the technology.
Tell us about Catherine and Henry. Who are they, and what is their relationship?
Well, because I was going to have at the center of this book an automaton, this first a duck, then it turned into a swan, they sort of get born because I need somebody in the present time to be trying to figure out how to assemble this thing, and then I need the other half of the story, which is the person who is going to commission it and have it made. They're joined by the object. They're working on the same puzzle. They're doing, sometimes touching the same thing. In one chapter, Catherine will touch it and Henry will touch it in the other. And in the end, because she also is his reader, she's reading his notebooks. So Catherine, I decided, and I don't know why, would have lost her secret lover. None of their friends, nobody they work with knows about it. One person knows and gives her this very strange, ambiguous gift, which is, say, put together this automaton.
She's given this project to distract her from her
grief. To distract her as a gift, an act of great kindness, actually. And then she discovers, when she's unpacking the crates, which she doesn't really want to unpack, but she finds Henry's notebooks and learns how he's come to have this, what he wants as a duck, what he gets as a swan, how he's come to commission this 150 years before. So that's how we get into Henry's story. He's probably not the brightest man you ever met, but I like him, and he is an optimist. He's the one who the glass is always half full for Henry.
Can you talk a little bit about the device of this dual narrative? It's something that you've used before, but what does it allow you to do? Why was it necessary to have these two parallel stories?
Well, because I was interested in the present and I was interested in the past. And the only reason I'm ever really interested in about the past is because of its effect on the present. And although, you know, the part of this book is set in the 19th century with characters living in the 19th century, we too are living in the consequences of the 19th century. And so it's really quite simple in this case. I mean, you have one character who's living in 2010 and one character who's living in 1858. And these are, you know, ways to know them directly, to know them from inside. So I rather like that. And the other thing generally I've always liked about differing points of view, and in an earlier time I might have had 6 or 7 or 8 different points of view, is that I always think that, you know, the truth is sort of complicated, if there is such a thing. And it's only by seeing, you know, contradictions between things that, you know, one person seeing it one way and another person seeing it another, that we have some notion of the truth. But that's less so of this particular book.
The title is also captivating, The Chemistry of Tears. I mean, tears are something that the mechanical swan can't generate.
No. But I was thinking about, you know, our bodies and how amazing they are. And I shouldn't really admit this, but what the title came from was a Google search, because I thought, I don't know anything about tears, but I bet you they do all sorts of things that I don't know about. And indeed, they do. So there's one that anesthetizes the eye a little bit. There's one that gives you some pleasure, a little bit like the pleasure you have in having sex. And this is quite aside from the thing of lubricating the eyes. And so the information about the tears goes into the book. But it seemed to me to encapsulate the book in the sense that we are looking at human yearning and human pain and loss and fear of death and searches for other meanings, and at the same time the notion of chemistry, which is sort of seems to sort of go against the feeling of things. So I wanted to combine science and feeling, I suppose.
Peter Carey, his new novel is called The Chemistry of Tears. Mr. Carey, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you very much. It was fun.
Gideon Lewis Krauss was confused. A few years ago, the American 20-something was living in Berlin, hanging out in art galleries and nameless speakeasies, preoccupied with living a creatively meaningful life, but kind of unsure about what that meant or how to make it happen. So when a friend asked him to join him on a pilgrimage in Spain, he went, hoping to find some answers. After Spain, Lewis Krauss went on to complete two other famous pilgrimages, one in Japan and one in the Ukraine. The result of that experience is a new memoir called A Sense of Direction. Gideon Lewis Krauss joins us now from our New York studios. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rachel.
So tell me a little bit about the first trip you go on is with a friend of yours, Tom,
right.
Also a writer. And the trip, this is a famous pilgrimage. This
is
a religious pilgrimage, right?
Well, this is one of the interesting things. It was a fairly serious religious pilgrimage for 1,000 years. And then in the last 30 years, it's become strangely ahistorically popular with a young, mostly secular crowd. So we met almost nobody who was doing it for explicitly religious reasons. These days, what most people do is they start at the French-Spanish border on the French side of the Pyrenees, and they walk to Santiago de Compostela. It's about 550 miles. Takes most people about a month.
Thousands of people do this particular walk in Spain every year. And you describe in the book this greeting that people
Buen
give
Camino.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That pilgrims give one another on
very,
the trail.
Very, very useful, because it can mean a whole variety of things. Hello, it very frequently means goodbye, as in, like, it was nice to meet you, walk on. You know, you would meet someone and like them, and then you would spend a week walking with them, and then all of a sudden, Buen Camino. It was simultaneously the, like, have a good, spiritually satisfying, meaningful journey, and also, like, buzz off. I'm tired of seeing you.
I noticed, though, there's also a lot of judging on the trail. I mean, you kind of think of the pilgrimage and pilgrims as being these very humble, kind of enlightened souls. But it gets kind of catty. You start judging people, differentiating people who do the entire trail and those who kind of cut in.
Yeah. Anybody who started even 10 feet after you was an inauthentic pilgrim, was not doing the whole thing. And it's just a way of differentiating yourself as you go along and dealing with the anxiety you have about doing this absurd thing.
You come out of your experience in Spain and you don't stop there. You decide you want to take another journey, this time in Japan.
Well, so while I was on the Camino in Spain, I met these two Japanese people. And two of them got very excited and said, we have this thing, the Shikoku Ohenro. It's sort of like the Japanese Camino. And I looked it up, and it's this circuit of 88 Buddhist temples that ring the smallest of the four Japanese islands. And it's very similar to the Camino. It also was wildly popular during the Middle Ages because in Japan it was literally the only reason under the feudal shoguns, the only reason you could leave home was if you were on a religious pilgrimage. It's a little less than 900 miles. It takes most people about 6 weeks, and maybe 10 to 12 foreigners do it a year. So I met two other foreigners while I was there.
So this is a fundamental difference from the experience that you just had in Spain. In that experience, there were all these people and pilgrims, and it was this communal experience.
Yes.
In Japan, you're alone, basically.
I was very, very alone. I met almost nobody. I went weeks without talking to anyone. It's almost all on asphalt, as opposed to the Camino, which is all on these nice paths. And it was raining the whole time. But this is hard.
This is kind of what you think of as like the pilgrimage.
Exactly.
And you're alone. And,
exactly.
I mean, in some ways, was that a more authentic experience?
Well, I mean, one of the questions that I talk about in the book is what does this authenticity even mean? Because there are a lot of people who say, well, this isn't authentic anymore. It used to be this religious thing, and now it's just this kind of backpacker jaunt. And ultimately, these are all distinctions I reject. I say, you know, the fact that your feet are coming apart and the fact that you've been walking for 8 hours in the rain, I mean, like, authenticity is the last thing that you care about.
Gideon, you are using these walks to try to do some thinking about the relationship you've had with your dad.
Right.
Which becomes a central theme in the book. And for your final pilgrimage, you set out to go to Ukraine. It's not so much a long walk as this kind of massive gathering to pay homage to a Jewish mystic. And you invite your brother and your dad to join you on this.
Mm-hmm. Well, so the book had, as I had gone on, the book had really become about this idea of pilgrimage as pretext, that it was always a pretext to leave home. It was a pretext to take some time to think about your life. It was a pretext to think about forgiveness and all these things. And then I thought, okay, well, if this is about the kind of pretext you need to make to try to change your life, I'm going to use this Jewish pilgrimage as a pretext to have all of the conversations with my dad about his life and his sexuality.
We should say he was he came out late
yeah,
in life.
So, my dad came out when I was 19. So I thought, like, okay, this is we're going to use this ridiculous Jewish pilgrimage that I basically have no interest in, full of, like, all these Hasids that I definitely do not identify with, to have these conversations with my dad.
You guys just couldn't go to a deli on the Upper West Side and call
it a day?
Well,
no. See, that's the thing about pilgrimage, is that if you go to a deli, then you're just – it's like another day that you're at a deli. Whereas, like, if you fly to the Ukraine – the whole idea of pilgrimage is that you're hoping that you're going to rise to the occasion in some way, right? So you hope that there is going to be something structural about the idea of making a miserable trip. I mean, we had this terrible trip on Aeroflot, and we finally got there, and then we had to drive through Ukraine in the night, fearing about getting shaken down by cops. So all of these, you know, minor but real austerities then, I think, primed us to be like, we're in a special place doing a special thing. We're going to rise to the occasion of having really serious and candid talks here that we would not have in a deli on the Upper West Side.
Did it work? Did you get what you wanted?
It did. I mean, it was absolutely exceeded all of my expectations, really. It was amazing. By the end of it, we kind of had to flee in haste from these Hasids because we had just had too much. So we, like, ran out with our suitcases and our unkosher meat and got into the rental car and shook off the Ukrainian cops and, like, got onto the highway and just, like, we're on our way to Odessa and just breathed a sigh of relief. And then we had just had this great vacation. And it felt completely different. It felt like something really new. It felt like a way that the three of us hadn't been together in a really long time.
Author Gideon Lewis Krauss, his new memoir is called A Sense of Direction. He spoke with us from our New York studios. Gideon, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Rachel. This has been great.
The star of John Irving's new novel, In One Person, his 13th book, is Billy Abbott. Billy is a character who's at the mercy of his own teenage crushes, which are visited upon a whole repertory company of gender-bending characters. And it is a repertory company. Billy spends many a day backstage at the local theater, where his family members are regulars. For instance, his grandfather.
Harry Marshall played all kinds of women. My grandfather loved the theater, and I loved watching him perform. But perhaps there were folks in First Sister, Vermont, who had rather limited imaginations. They knew Harry Marshall was a lumberman. They couldn't accept him as a woman. I told Grandpa Harry about watching some of our fellow townspeople who were caught in the act of watching him. You know what I say, Bill? Grandpa Harry asked me. I say, you can make believe what you want. There were tears in my eyes then because I was afraid for myself, not unlike the way as a child I had been afraid backstage for Grandpa Harry. I stole Elaine Hadley's bra because I wanted to wear it, I blurted out. Ah, well, that's a good fella's failing, Bill. I wouldn't worry about that, Grandpa Harry said. It was strange what a relief it was to see that I couldn't shock him. Harry Marshall was only worried about my safety, as I'd once been afraid for his.
In One Person is a coming-of-age novel in which that person, Billy Abbott, grows up relationship by relationship, some with women, some with men, some with people who may be a bit of both. We asked John Irving, who recently turned 70, about the effect desire can have at a young age.
There's a moment, I think, in most of our childhood years, those prepubescent bordering on puberty years. Those aren't the easiest parts of ourselves for many of us to remember. But I remember that in my imagination, I was at one time or another attracted to just about everyone, to my friends' mothers to girls my own age, even to some older boys on the wrestling team. Well, as it turned out, I liked girls, but I think a part of our tolerance for sexual differences surely comes from being honest about what we remember of ourselves. So I just tried to be, in this novel, faithful to what utter havoc the mutability of gender can be for many young people in their formative years.
This novel takes place against a backdrop of a lot of references to great works of theater, including Shakespeare and Ibsen. What was it about these works that appealed to you when telling this story of identity?
I got my storytelling from the theater. My mother was a prompter in a small town theater, and I did grow up, much as Billy does, backstage. As a child, every play I saw, I had seen in rehearsal, sometimes for months. I knew everything that happened. I knew what the actors said before they spoke their lines. People have commented, sometimes with irritation, sometimes nicely, on the amount of foreshadow that there is in my novels. Well, yeah, it's not so hard to foreshadow what's coming when you know what's coming. When you are writing to, as I do, a predetermined ending. I begin my novels knowing what happens. I write endings first. I write last sentences, sometimes last paragraphs first. I write collision course stories. There is always something coming that the reader anticipates. What you can't know is when and who the casualties will be and who the survivors will be. But you see the what. You know what's coming. The collision that's coming in One Person, I think it's pretty evident in the early going. You're hearing a story about the development and the growing self-awareness of a bisexual boy. It's the 1950s and 60s, and you know you are listening to the voice of an older man who is, he tells you, almost 70. You know that many of these characters you're meeting are going to coincide with the AIDS epidemic. You just don't know when or how or who's going to come out the other side and who isn't. That's not a surprise.
Is it different to write about sexuality when you're in your 70s than, say, when you're in your 30s?
Well, maybe you can be a little more forthright or a little more honest about it because you no longer have anything to protect. You're past that time in your life where you're imagining yourself as sexually attractive to someone. I just think as an older person, you can be more candid with yourself about who you were and how thoroughly intimidating and confusing and conflicted the world of adult sexuality seemed when you were on the doorstep of it, but still standing outside.
Mr. Irving, you're perhaps the only novelist I know who's in the Wrestling Hall of Fame. What do you find so continually fascinating about wrestling?
Many of my wrestling friends find it odd that I'm a writer, just as many of my friends in the writing world find it odd that I was for so many years a wrestler and a wrestling coach. But they seem very similar to me. In both cases, you have to be devoted to tireless repetition and small details for many more hours than you will ever be in competition. You will be with a nameless workout partner, a sparring partner, drilling the same outside single leg dive, inside collar tie, hundreds upon thousands of times. Well, how many times as a writer do you, or should you, rewrite the same sentence, the same paragraph, the same chapter? if you're good, you'd never tire of that.
There's one difference that occurs to me. Wrestling is now, it's a spectator sport for you. You're still a major participant in writing. What's your next match?
Well, I began a new novel on Christmas Eve. My youngest son of three was home for Christmas, and he came into my office and said, he said, "It's Christmas Eve. What are you doing, writing a new novel?" And I said, "Yes, I think I am, actually. I think I just have." So I don't intend to stop. Dropping dead at my desk sounds like a pretty good idea to me.
John Irving, his 13th novel, is In One Person. Mr. Irving, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Liz Winstead has always looked at life a little differently. As a little girl growing up in Minnesota, she was often upbraided for asking impertinent questions and saying something inappropriate. It served her well when she became a comedian. She's written a book of essays called Liz Free or Die that takes readers through the different chapters of her life, growing up, becoming a comic, helping to create The Daily Show back in 1996, which has since gone on to huge success. But she had a showbiz debut that could have been her last performance.
It is possibly the greatest horror story and the greatest gift that I have received in my career in comedy.
It was Minneapolis in the 1980s. Liz Winstead was hosting the finals of an air guitar contest called The Great Pretenders.
And so I was wearing this big white Madonna ball gown that I got at a thrift store that was kind of ripped up. And behind me was a gigantic video screen to where the performers were waiting, and then the screen would roll up and they would sing. So I'm about to introduce the first act. The screen rolls up and the dress rolls up in the screen behind me.
Liz Winstead found herself vulnerable and exposed, nude from the waist down, and trapped in the machinery. So, she told a joke, then another. Suddenly, the audience was laughing with her, not at her. Some people even thought she'd planned it that way. A career in comedy was launched. Liz Winstead grew up one of five children of conservative Catholic parents, and, like a lot of kids, she says she loved her Barbie doll. But Barbie didn't mean impossibly perfect, pulchritudinous plastic beauty to young Liz, but something different.
You know, I looked at Barbie as sort of the pinnacle of freedom, where she had her own dream house, she had a car, she had a boyfriend that I could choose when he showed up.
And what he was wearing.
He was wearing. That's exactly right. And so being the youngest of five kids and never getting my voice in anyway, I looked at her as somebody to completely emulate. And I didn't really even notice the crazy, curvy, plastic doll that people have come to, feminists have come to, you know, take on. And I remember being in college and taking a feminist studies class early on, and Barbie was under assault. I was like, but wait, isn't Barbie a feminist? Like, I completely perceived her as a feminist, even though her feet, she couldn't walk, but she could drive.
How did you find out you were funny?
Well, it's genetic in my family. My father is from Mississippi and a long line of storytellers, and all of my siblings are incredibly gifted at telling stories. And I think for years I knew that I had a funny bone, but stand-up comedy or pursuing comedy as a career never occurred to me, simply because in my coming of age, when I would turn on The Tonight Show, I didn't see any women really on television doing stand-up, unless they were older women like Toni Fields or Joan Rivers. And so I didn't see anyone like me. It was either men in suits talking about what men in suits talk about, or women, if they were older, talking about how much their husbands disappointed them and sort of the level that their boobs had sunk to on their body. That was a very popular thing to talk about for a lot of comedians back in the day. And so it wasn't until I was watching George Carlin one night with a girlfriend of mine, and she said, "Why don't you try that?" And I said, I don't know. I do you think I could?" And she said, "Why not?" I wasn't really like a goofball or didn't really tell jokes as a kid. I think more in high school did I realize it's easier to be funny than it is to be angry. Because there's this interesting thing. If you make someone laugh, you have a bond. And so if you can make someone laugh who you disagree with, they have to acknowledge that on some level they like you. And sometimes then you can work things out.
Some of the most moving sections of your book have to do with your father's last days.
Yes.
And you invent a word that I have grown to admire since reading it, dilarious.
Yes, dilarious. Laughing with or at the expense of someone who is dying. And it is a word that I didn't ever use until my father passed away. My father was this amazing, funny Southern storyteller, and our politics were diametrically opposed. He was a staunch Reagan Republican, and I'm a crazy liberal. And we found this fun detente where we would watch Jeopardy together. Because if we both could answer, what is the Sudetenland, at the same time, then we couldn't call each other dumb. And he always said to me, he said, you know, I raised you kids to have an opinion, and I forgot to tell you it was supposed to be mine. Which is such a brilliant thing. And so about 6 months before he passed away, he sent me this beautiful card. And on the inside, it said, I love you. You are my favorite. Don't tell the others. And I thought, oh, my God. The problem with the card is that he said on the card, don't open this until I'm gone. And finally, when he passed away, we were all sitting in the room, and my mom said, oh, your father really was excited to send you cards. I would love to hear what the card said. And I said, you know, Mom, maybe another time, maybe after the funeral, we can all read the cards. And so she goes, and I want you to start, Liz. And I was gobsmacked. And so I said, okay. The card said, I love you. You're my favorite. And then everyone else chimed in, don't tell the others. He had sent the exact same card to all of us and actually planned with my mom so that he could, upon his death, the first thing we would do is laugh and not cry.
Your mother sounds like an extraordinary character.
Yeah. She was one of those mothers who, she was never overtly critical. She was very Minnesota backhanded critical. But she always did support me in a way that was pretty incredible. She would defend me to the death, take my pictures when I was on the TV because they didn't have a VCR, and then show those pictures, or cut out clippings when I was in the paper. If I was like a young comic and I was booked as And Others, it was like Louis Anderson and Others, she would cut out And Others, put that in a box. And I think part of it, too, was I grew up with conservative parents in a very progressive community in Minneapolis. And so she would say things to me in her later years in the retirement and say, well, you know, sometimes at my dinner table at the retirement home, they sit me with the Democrats. And I've said I'd rather sit with the Alzheimer's people. And so, yeah, she was quite a character in her own right. Very different sensibility than my dad. But, you know, it was, again, just lucky to have these gifts from these parents who reiterated how much humor was part of us and how important it was to keep it going. Now I feel like I have a legacy that I'm carrying on.
Liz Winstead. Her new collection of essays, Liz Free or Die, speaking from New York. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.